The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. There's got to be some thinking that is beyond that of the common man that goes on in the Pentagon and the State Department. There is some wonderful logic that you and I can never achieve, some beautiful method of arriving at what appears to Pentagon and State Department spokesmen to be crystal clear logic. And some of the exciting rhetoric you hear these days from these new preachers and practitioners of the double talk, innuendo, shaded meaning, the double entendre, the hyperbole, the non sequitur, and just the crass stupidity that I hear coming out of some of those quarters is almost unbelievable. Now, maybe you don't quite follow me, but what I'm talking about is the following scene. What if the NRA, the National Rifle Association in the United States, said, "We have just purchased 3 million M1 Garand rifles, and we're distributing them free of charge to citizens all over the country at the following locations. However, we want you to know that we are not intending by doing this to increase whatsoever the number of arms in private hands." Washington announces that the United States has approved a $750 million deal to provide Saudi Arabia with several squadrons of Northrop F-5 jet fighters and spare parts. They also announced that this has nothing to do whatsoever with contributing to an arms race in the Middle East. This logic, this wonderful, exciting rhetoric, this crystal clear explanation kind of boggles the mind, doesn't it? There's some weird, exotic, wonderful method of reasoning that some of these, quote, official government spokesmen achieve that you and I, the common man, simply cannot follow. The layman simply cannot follow the devious meanderings of the human mind that lead people to actually believe, and if they don't believe, at least to say without shamefacedness, without crystal, beautiful, bright, purple, blazing, red embarrassment written plainly on their face as they say, this has nothing to do with contributing to an arms race in the Middle East. Well, we were told recently, as I was talking in the last program, that Iran has ordered many of the new F-14 super sophisticated and supersonic American operational jets that are even a generation beyond the swing-wing F-111 fighter bomber that was so sensationalized during the McNamara and the Vietnam era. The F-14 Tomcat built by Grumman for the Navy and its prototype, or an exact type just like it actually, which is the F-15 built by McDonnell Douglas, which was purchased by the Air Force, is the greatest, the best all-around fighter that the United States has ever designed. But our own armed forces are going to have to wait a while while we equip the Iranian Air Force with those F-14s. And you know those wonderful new attack helicopters, those jet-powered jobs that are supposed to be able to be operable in just about total zero-zero weather? I mean the blackest night with sheets of rain coming down and they're flying and killing people anyway. Well, our Army wanted hundreds of those as attack helicopters, but they're going to have to wait 2 to 3 years while we send most of all that we can afford to build over to the Iranians. Then Iran wanted hundreds of tanks. There are going to be more than 1,000 sent from Britain alone, more than the British maintain in their Army of the Rhine. Those go to Iran. As a matter of fact, they even diverted immediately when they found out Iran wanted to buy in the marketplace and Britain needs the money. And so no matter what you've been told for the last decades, forget NATO. Forget the thin line stretched so thin that is standing over there like the bulwark between the East and the West that is beleaguered and wondering when some communist onslaught is going to come. Remember all the propaganda of the post-World War II era and the Cold War and the Berlin Wall and Checkpoint Charlie and American and British and French troops that were facing those monumental mammoth avalanches of Russian tanks and divisions that were amassed along the Eastern European borders with all the satellites? Forget all that propaganda. Forget the whole reason behind the American defense expenditures of all the years preceding and during Vietnam. All of our preoccupation over Europe, our desire to keep NATO forces equipped with top-level equipment, to keep them in good spirits and morale, no matter what the real truth is about the terrible morale and the terrible problem they're causing America for Western Germany and vice versa. Forget it all. When Britain found out Iran wanted to recycle some of those vast piles of oil dollars, of OPEC money, back into the staggering, faltering, sick to the death British economy, They just sent the first 45 of those tanks right straight out of the British Rhine Army. They grabbed them out of Germany and they said, get them on board ships and get them over there quick before those guys change their mind. You think Britain and the United States are really all that scared about a communist attack against Western Europe? Pish twaddle. Why, they'll strip the European Defense Forces bare, which the United States, by the way, did virtually the same thing in the Jew-Arab War of 1973. We transshipped a lot of our F-4 fighters and other equipment that was committed to NATO forces and sent them down to Israel, which is why the Germans got embarrassed when the Arabs retaliated by an oil embargo against some of Europe and began to shake a finger in our nose and say, you better not do that anymore. No, the posture that your tax dollars have got to go for that terrible, costly maintenance of arms and materiel and men in Western Europe is ridiculous on its face if, when the Iranians come to the market for arms, the British will immediately strip their tanks in Western Europe and send them to Iran as fast as they can get them there. Can you imagine, though, how embarrassing it would be these days to be a Pentagon or a spokesman for the Pentagon or for the United States State Department, and to announce, as was announced recently, that as a part of the deal, the United States will train the Saudi pilots and the technicians that they need to operate, maintain, to repair, to replace parts and all that, to service all of this equipment. The State Department spokesman in this case was Robert Anderson, who said the sale had been approved, quote, in view of America's continuing military relationship with Saudi Arabia and that country's defense needs, end quote. Now, no doubt, that country's defense needs have become a little more crystal clear to that country as a result of what Mr. Kissinger said when he refused to rule out the use of force from the United States in the Middle East in the event of the cutting off of those oil wells. So no doubt that country, meaning Saudi Arabia, has defense needs against the United States. Now, since Mr. Kissinger said that in Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Kuwait and Abu Dhabi and Dubai and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and Iran and all the rest of them obviously need to defend themselves against the United States, why, we've got a better idea. There's no reason to send them shopping to the dumb Soviet Union, who doesn't need the money, wouldn't know what to do with it anyway. We need the money, badly. And our Army and Air Force, Marine Corps and Coast Guard and Navy can't afford it. They don't have any money. They're broke. You know, they get very tight little budgets, and the Air Force says, where are my airplanes? And the spokesman and the Pentagon and the State Department says, well, I'm sorry, you got to wait a couple years on yours. We've got to sell these to Iran so we can get the money to build the ones you want. So wait a while. And the Navy Admiral comes around and says, where are my nuclear attack carriers? You guys are stripping the Navy bare. We've got an old, obsolete, outdated fleet sitting around rusting in mothballs. Our ships are on the average about 20-some years of age. The Soviet fleet is brand spanking new, nuclear powered. They've got a super sophisticated fleet at sea. They're moving into the Indian Ocean. They've about taken over the Mediterranean. They're a world power now, not only a maritime fleet and fishing and stripping the United States West Coast and Alaska bare of salmon and the rest of it, but they got a gigantic nuclear powered navy. When do I get my carriers? The answer is, well, you wait on yours. We've got to build one and give it away to Saudi Arabia or to Iran or one of those guys in the Persian Gulf first to protect themselves from American carriers in that area. The word was the other day that the American nuclear carrier, the Constellation, sailed somewhere in the direction of the Indian Ocean from the Philippines. And the last time it appeared in the Persian Gulf, it scared the socks, or maybe if they don't wear socks, it may have at least caused a few of them to gird up their loins and run around with their knobby knees exposed over there in those deserts making footy prints in the sand. I mean, they had their headdresses and their checkered tablecloths just about strung straight out like somebody had starched his hair. They were scared half to death. They saw an American attack carrier in the Persian Gulf. Well, they decided to take care of that. They're buying hundreds of super sophisticated attack bombers, hundreds of surface-to-air and surface-to-surface missiles, thousands of tanks, hundreds of attack helicopters, and they want the United States to teach them how to use those things, which, of course, we're willing to do. So this wonderful logic, this exciting rhetoric, this crystal-clear logical explanation you hear from State Department spokesmen is, you've got to admit, some kind of a step of thinking that is beyond the common man. It's a kind of logic that escapes you and me. We probably would put 1, 2, and 3 together, 4 and 5 together, and come up with some kind of an equation that would be completely beyond anything that our State Department seems to arrive at. Their 2 and 2 doesn't make 4 like ours. They wouldn't say like you, now look, Mr. Kissinger says we may have to use force soon against Saudi Arabia. You know, the broad majority of the Americans don't even believe there's an energy crisis anyway, but when we finally find out there is, no matter what we believe, that there really is an energy crisis, we're going to be screaming for some more oil for our toys. Now, our logic might be that if Mr. Kissinger says someday in the future it's not impossible in some grave emergency that American young men would be at war against Saudi Arabia, and then we turn around and supply Saudi Arabia with all the fighter jets and all the equipment they need and train them how to use it, and we might say, our logic might read like this, well, look, wouldn't our own boys be going over there, maybe even not as equipped as they should be? Maybe the units to which they're attached wouldn't even have the newest attack helicopters, but Saudi Arabia would. Maybe the units to which they're attached in the Navy wouldn't have those attack carriers with the helicopters aboard, but Saudi Arabia would. Maybe their units off the carriers wouldn't have enough of those F-14s, but Saudi Arabia and Iran and a lot of other countries would. Aren't we going to be fighting against our own equipment, trained by Americans? Now, you and I might think, yeah, that's what it looks like. But no, there's some reasoning in there that the State Department has arrived at that isn't the way you and I would reason. By the way, this is real cute. Here's a quote right out of the AP wires here. It says, State Department officials said they, quote, had no fear that the sale of the jets would contribute to an arms race in the Middle East, end of quote. Isn't that unbelievable? I see. That's like, as I said, giving away about 1 million rifles and saying, but have no fear, this does not contribute whatsoever to any kind of an arms race in a private sector. I mean, this doesn't really mean that a lot more guns are going to be in the hands of private citizens. Just because we're sending hundreds of aircraft and hundreds or even thousands of tanks and maybe even some destroyers. Oh, yeah, the Navy's got to wait for a new class destroyer. It's called the Spruance, by the way, because the United States shipyards have got an order from some of the Arabians over there. Some of those Arabs want some of those top-quality, super-sophisticated missile-firing destroyers, and so our shipyards are just standing on their heads with glee. You're not going to see an awful lot of unemployment in the yards that are building those Spruance-class destroyers. They're happy. They're getting a paycheck, even if it is in Arabic. Isn't it unbelievable? Now, State Department officials said they had no fear that the sale of those jets would contribute to an arms race in the Middle East. What in the world is an arms race if it isn't buying arms? Oh, well. I'm going to try to go back to college, and I'm going to take me a class in State Department reasoning. I'm sure there's got to be one somewhere. Those guys have been to college, haven't they? There had to be a course somewhere that is called Pentagon Pulchritude. No, Pentagon Perspicacity, Sagacity, Wisdom, or maybe Hyperbole, or maybe it should be called State Department Non Sequiturs. But anyway, somewhere, somehow, there's a way to learn how to reason like that. Now, apparently, both Iran and Saudi Arabia are in a giant hurry, and both of them have leaders who have reasons to be. The Shah of Iran is up in his mid-50s. He's in a big hurry. He wants to become one of the most powerful nations on the face of the earth and do it while he's still virile enough to sit around and enjoy it. And then, of course, King Faisal's in a hurry. He wants to kiss the stone inside the Dome of the Rock, and he wants to walk freely around the eastern city of Jerusalem, because he is the living monarch over the nation that looks upon itself as the spiritual leader of the world's 600 million Muslims. Because his kingdom encompasses Islam's two holiest cities, Mecca and Medina. You see, the Arabs over there don't have our calendar. They talk about the Hajira. And the Hajira was the trip that was made by the Prophet Muhammad, his pilgrimage from Medina to Mecca. So everybody goes to Mecca these days. That is, everybody who is Arab. Now, if you are, you probably can't. Don't think any Americans have been there. It seemed to me out of my memory somewhere comes the idea that some Westerner was allowed a glimpse of that city in the last few years. But otherwise, it's pretty much closed to anybody except a member of the Islam religion. Well, the king, who is also in a hurry because he's now 68, wants to be able to pray sometime within his lifetime in Jerusalem. at the Dome of the Rock, from which they say Muhammad descended into heaven. And he wants to walk around there, walk up to it, and maybe kiss it and pray at it, without ever setting foot on Israeli-held territory. Now that has a few sticky problems in there somewhere. The Israelis not only hold it, but they've absorbed it, digested it, masticated it, made it a part of their very body. You see, we maintain offices. My son's in East Jerusalem right now while I'm talking to you, in an office that is leased from an Arab family. It's right down the street, about a quarter of a mile from what used to be a summer home, up in the high elevations there, of King Hussein. Now, I'm here to tell you that the Israeli government has completely made as if one integrated city, the sewage, the flow of water, electricity of that old city and all of its environs on out toward Benanina, and the Jewish part of the newer city of Jerusalem. It's all like one city. The bus lines, everything, it just flows like one city. Furthermore, they have built many, many permanent stone high-rise apartments all over that part of Jerusalem at an expenditure of hundreds of millions, I'm sure. And it's just as much a part of Israel territory today, both in appearance and in fact, as you might say half of any American city is of the other half. And to hear that King Faisal says that his dying wish is to walk around on that rock up there, but to do so without setting foot upon Israeli-held territory is just a little bit beyond the realm of possibility, as long as you're talking about peace. Now, Faisal says he wants peace. All the Arab leadership say they want peace. Meanwhile, they are girding for war and talking about war. So really, their reasoning is not too much different from our State Department, is it? They want peace, but they're willing to go to war to get it. The State Department says, we're sending arms to the Middle East, but don't worry about any increases in arms over there. Don't worry about there being an arms race. Well, Faisal hates Zionism with a cold passion. And he also hates communism, by the way, which is good for the West. We're glad of that. As a matter of fact, to show you that the reasoning of people high in office is above and beyond our reasoning, of which we might be capable, Faisal repeatedly says in public that he believes that Zionists and communists are allied in an effort to control the world. did you hear that? I'm giving you that as an example of the tremendous reasoning of the high plane of rational thinking that some of these people in high offices can reach. Here's the person who is the spiritual leader of 600 million Muslims, one of the most powerful figures in the world today as far as wealth and what the future would seem to hold, because Saudi Arabia has by far and away the largest oil reserves. So Faisal, if Iran doesn't beat him to it, should emerge eventually as the most powerful Arab figure in all of world history, including all the way back to Saladin and everybody else. I mean, you can go back into history anywhere you want to and look for some great empire ruled over by the Arabs. Let me tell you, Faisal's got a very good chance of emerging as the greatest of all time. Yet, maybe you would think that his reasoning is so astute and so crystal clear, and that he has maybe an intelligence network, and with his visits to world capitals and Moscow and elsewhere, that maybe he would really have a handle on what's happening in the world. Well, Faisal thinks and says publicly, about every time he gets a chance, that Zionist Jews and communists are working hand in glove to rule the world. Now, you figure that one out. On the future of Jerusalem, he says, and I quote his words, we regard the return of occupied Jerusalem to Arab administration as a very essential matter, and we cannot accept any compromise. Well, there you are. I mean, if you think peace is coming in the Middle East in 1975 or 1976 or 1977, just forget it. It's not going to, and more with the pouring of those dollars, the pouring of the wealth of the world, of the Western world, into the Middle East, with the pouring now of arms and weapons into the Middle East, from Britain, from France, from the United States, from all over the world. The Soviet Union has re-equipped Syria. And even though Sadat was kind of whimpering the other day and nearly tripped on his lower lip when he said, quote, we have not been yet compensated, end quote, for what we lost in our last war, you know, He wants some more weapons. He hasn't been compensated. I thought, what in the world is this? A big brother relationship? He's sitting on Brezhnev's knee with his thumb in his mouth, his nose dripping a little bit like a 12-year-old kid running around. Daddy, you haven't compensated me. That big bully took away my wallet. He wants some more arms, and he hasn't been compensated yet. But he's talking about peace. And what he's worried about is that, you know, the Arabs have a kind of a mystique involving virility and involving what they view as being the proof of their manhood. And if Syria should leap off and get the jump on the Egyptians and should attack Israel first, and the Syrians now have been far more equipped than Egypt, it might be a little loss of face. It might look like Syria is more of a leader and more virile and more masculine than the Egyptian leadership is. So Anwar Sadat said in an interview published recently that the Soviet Union had refused to replace the weapons Egypt lost during the October 1973 Arab-Israeli war. He said, quote, Egypt was not compensated for what it lost in the war, end quote. Well, that was when he made his now famous right to possess atomic weapons speech. So as you look at the Middle East in overview and in perspective, you see these two major leaders up in Iran, the Shah there, who wants to be some kind of a super Shah, and I can just say pshaw to that, but he wants to do it in a hurry. And then you look at Faisal, and he wants to walk the streets of a Jerusalem clearly in the hands of Saudi Arabia. And his whole idea, of course, is the extermination of the Israeli state, and the Israelis don't want to be exterminated. They've had enough of that. Nearly all of those people who came from Europe and are my age or older remember so well the torture camps. For instance, we're having the great honor of having, I would assume, one of the very greatest, if not the greatest, of all concert masters at the piano, Arturo Rubinstein, perform in the Ambassador College auditorium. Mr. Rubinstein is up in his late 80s. Well, every single member of his family was exterminated by Hitler and the pogroms. I think he had one or two cousins or something. About all he was left in the entire family. I mean, uncles and aunts and sisters and brothers and father and mother and everybody wiped out. Mr. Rubinstein, obviously, is Jewish. And he will not perform in West Germany to this day, or Austria. He just will not do it. Now, people that live over there, not only Americans, but those that have come from Western Europe, have just had it with this business of the extermination of the Jews. They don't believe in that. I don't blame them. I mean, if I were a living Jew in Israel, I wouldn't really want to go along with the idea of another nation that just wants me exterminated. So when the defense minister of Egypt says that now they have this other precondition in negotiation, which is they're insisting Israel clamp a 50-year moratorium on their policy of immigration, which is like saying to Israel, you got to quit growing. Let us Arabs continue to grow by leaps and bounds, having our population explosions unimpeded. And every time you whip us a little bit, that's all right. We can take those losses and still come up with about 70 men to replace the one you just killed. And sooner or later, we're going to wear you down. And that's exactly what they hope to do. Each setback is only viewed as a temporary thing on the part of the Arabs. They think eventually they're going to win out, and win out means literally driving the Israelis into the sea. So I don't care what you read in the newspapers about, quote, step-by-step negotiations, or about Mr. Kissinger getting over there. Unless Kissinger can change Faisal's religion. And Kissinger's a Jew, too, you know. I don't know what he is by religion. I know what he is by race, and I don't really know just how handicapped he might be in some areas of the Middle East in dealing with guys like Sadat and King Faisal. I really couldn't comment on that. Apparently, he's been fairly successful in the past, but that's because he has not represented the Israelis, but the United States, and, of course, has, in that sense, represented global interests and has gotten, I think, some tremendous concessions out of the Soviet Union. But here you have the Soviet Union eyeball to eyeball with the United States. The Soviet Union is arming Arabs, and the United States is arming Arabs. All of Western Europe, the super giant that is the powerful nation of Japan, all of Western Europe are lying prostrate, their jugular vein exposed, with an Arab scimitar poised delicately over that jugular vein, ready to fall. Meanwhile, you have the religious aspects of the spiritual leader of 600 million Muslims who says there is no compromise. He is determined to get East Jerusalem back when he never possessed it in the first place. But Jordan did. Then there's the PLO and that chubby little criminal jackass known as Yasser Arafat, who just now scored another success in that India recently became the first non-Arab country to extend formal recognition to the Palestine Liberation Organization. The Indian ambassador to Lebanon and PLO chairman Yasser Arafat signed documents accrediting a PLO representative to India. Its representative in India would have then the status of a diplomat. Imagine making a diplomat out of a murderer, out of a self-professed killer of unarmed women and children, a rapist, a mugger, a con artist, a dip, a demented killer. But that's what they're going to do. Of course, I guess it's been done before. What am I talking about? But he's going to enjoy privileges and diplomatic immunity. I guess that means the next time some of those slope-headed jackals hijack an American or a French or a Swiss or a West German airliner and shoot a lot of people, that they can fly it to India because they're going to be given diplomatic immunity down there. I guess that's what diplomatic immunity means, doesn't it? Immune by reasons of diplomacy? Now, I said at the beginning of this program, there's got to be some kind of reasoning that is used by people in these high echelons of government, even in our own State Department, in our Pentagon and elsewhere, that is beyond the kind of reasoning you and I might use faced with similar circumstances. And you know, I really think it is beyond. I think it's the same kind of reasoning that you will find if you were to go to some of the funny farms and watch people playing around with their hands and pretending to be Napoleon or George Washington or Louis the 16th. To me, it's absolutely insane to say that we are not contributing to an arms race in the Middle East, yet we are pouring super sophisticated advanced weapons systems, attack helicopters capable of operating in virtual zero-zero visibility, fast, modern warships that our own U.S. Navy can't seem to afford, hundreds, no, thousands of tanks, Britain and America both getting in on that act, and hundreds of supersonic jet aircraft of several types to the Middle East. You figure it out. I think it's a little beyond me. I don't know exactly where to go to find how to understand that kind of reasoning, but I'll guarantee you this, there is going to be no peace in the Middle East in 1975. And it just could be. Mr. Kissinger's words will prove to be very horribly prophetic someday. And what a wretched, filthy fiasco it's going to be. And who's going to explain it then? If the United States is involved in a war in the Middle East, fighting against its own arms and equipment, in the hands of people we ourselves have trained.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.